Hello, this is Wolfman611, and you're listening to Audio Netcast number 1. On today's show, we'll be talking about a range of topics from security to gaming. So let's dig into the first topic on the list. And this is going to be about the latest rumblings I've been hearing about cold boot attacks. For those that don't know, a cold boot attack involves having a computer turned on, and then you plug in, a bootable USB drive. Once the drive is plugged in, you reset the computer. When the computer has been reset, and assuming you have your USB port set to do bootloading, the external hard drive plugged in will auto-load a utility that will then go into RAM and look for passwords or whatever else you have in there. Say, for example, a password that's been used in a full disk encryption program would be a good example. Once the program finds that password, it can dump at the disk. The other method is, instead of looking for passwords, the person doing this could have the program do a memory dump to the external hard disk and then take the memory dump back to their place or wherever, where they can examine it at a later date and time and do a more thorough search on it. You don't have to worry about, you know, anybody catching them doing what they're doing, because they're gone. They got it at home with them. I think what a lot of people find most disconcerting about this is the fact that most people probably think that once you kill the power to the computer, that the RAM gets wiped out right away. As the Princeton University study shows, though, the RAM decays over a matter of seconds. If you have a can of compressed air with you and access to the RAM chips, you can freeze the RAM chips. This will drop down to -0, and this will make the RAM decay at a much slower rate. With a slower rate of decay, you can get about 30 minutes out of the RAM chips before they start to lose their contents. So that's quite a bit of time. I mean, if you can actually do that to the chips, you can take the chips, that's enough time to drive somewhere, put the chips inside a machine, like inside another machine, do another dump, and, you know, start going through the RAM contents again. This is highly unlikely, but, it, you know, it is possible. 30 minutes is quite a bit of time. I was reading a report the other night where researchers have started to work on a program that, like the one mentioned above, will go through RAM and find all kinds of passwords for programs like MSN Messenger and even email clients, as well as other programs. One sure way to defeat any of these types of attacks is, don't let anything boot on your machine other than the main hard disk. If you turn off ports you're not using, like the FireWire and the USB ports, so they do not boot stuff from power-up, you will be safe from attacks like this. One thing both of these attacks make you think about is, what about offices that don't have good IT staff or very good security policies? I can see a lot of offices getting hosed with these two attacks mentioned above, because people simply don't expect that type of attack in the first place, and therefore they don't have their computers locked down for it. I think the software industry as a whole needs to address these types of attacks. The reason the second program can go through and find MSN passwords along with email passwords is because those programs are not clearing the RAM where the password was sitting after the password was used for a password check. If the software makers would wipe the RAM after the password check, it would make it much more difficult for any would-be attackers to find any passwords at all. Software makers should also move the password around in memory when they do need to make a check, so it's not always sitting in the same spot and making itself an easy target for programs that are going through memory looking for passwords. I'll keep a close eye on this security issue and sure to report back should there be any more major developments. Next up, Pwn2Own. In other security news, Vancouver, Canada, the second annual Pwn2Own contest got underway last week with some interesting results. For those that don't know, the Pwn2Own contest is set up by CanSec West. The contest is run once a year to see who can exploit any of the 3 laptop systems they have. The laptops consisted of a MacBook Air and 2 other laptops running Windows Vista, and the other laptop was running Ubuntu. Day 1 of the event was set up so that the only way you could compromise any of the laptops had to be via remote exploit, meaning no user interaction at all on the laptops. From what I understand, no one bothered trying to exploit the machines on day 1 of the contest. Some people think the reason no one bothered with the machines on day 1 of the contest is due to the fact the code exploit to take over a computer remotely is worth way more then the contest is willing to give out in prize money, so no one bothered at all with it. I have read that some of these exploits, if good enough, can be sold for upwards of $70,000, so no one is going to give away an exploit like that for a mere $20,000, even if they throw in a laptop that might be worth a couple thousand. Day 2 of the event, the computer researchers were allowed to finally get their fingers on the computers, and it was at this point that the MacBook Air fell to an attack in under 1 minute. The attack was done via the Safari web browser that comes with the Mac OS. Day 3 of the contest, and the last day of it, would end with Windows Vista laptop being exploited via a flash exploit. So by the end of the contest, the only laptop left that wasn't hacked was the Ubuntu laptop. It should be noted, though, that the flash exploit that brought down the Windows Vista laptop could have been reworked to affect both the Mac and Ubuntu laptops as well. The only reason the flash exploit wasn't used on the Ubuntu computer was the guy who did the exploit for Vista didn't have enough time to actually make the exploit work on the Ubuntu machine as well. I guess when he got it to go on Vista, it was getting near the end of the competition. And by the time he got Vista exploited, that was it. The contest was over. So Ubuntu was the only one left standing. It should be noted that all three of these laptops, before the contest was started, were fully patched and up to date with all security patches from their appropriate vendors. This is an interesting type of competition, but I would like to see it expanded a bit more. For example, it would be nice to know how many people bothered trying to attack each one of these laptop systems. Also, how long did it take for each one of these attacks to be pulled off for each system? I would also like the companies like Apple and Microsoft and Conical to step up and donate some prize money to this competition since it's directly tied to their products. After all, if they patch all these security holes that these guys are finding, that makes their products a better product. So, fork out a little bit of cash, Microsoft, and all the rest of these guys. TrueCrypt version 5.1a. A few weeks ago, the latest version of TrueCrypt was released, and in the latest version of it, you can do full disk encryption, and this now includes encrypting the hibernation file as well. The version of TrueCrypt prior to this could do full disk encryption, but wasn't able to deal with hibernation. For those that don't know, TrueCrypt is a very strong encryption package, where you can either do full disk encryption, or have TrueCrypt make a virtual file system known as a container file, that you can then mount and then get a drive letter for, and you can put files in it and all that stuff. Works just like a normal drive. As soon as you unmount it, though, everything's fully encrypted. Nobody can access it. If you plan to use TrueCrypt in any form, you'll want to make sure that your password is good. The encryption is only as good as the password. So, for example, if you use TrueCrypt to make your password dog or cat, you can be sure that your super safe data you have encrypted won't be that way for very long. Always use a good passphrase that has letters, both upper and lowercase, along with some mixed-in numbers as well, and you should be good to go. If you decide to use TrueCrypt and you forget your password, you're out of luck because there are no backdoors to override your password if you manage to lose the password you set up. TrueCrypt is also very fast. I've been hearing reports from a few people that the actual disk I/O after TrueCrypt has been installed is faster than not having TrueCrypt on the system at all. Some people may wonder how something can encrypt every byte of data on the hard drive and be quicker than not using the program at all. And the answer is the I/O driver for TrueCrypt has been done very well, and also done fully in assembly. And this ensures that the I/O is as fast as possible. So there you have it. If you want TrueCrypt, the links will be in the show notes at the end of this podcast. You can hop over to the website, and all the links for all these stories will be down there. You can read them. Go to the websites and check the stuff out. On to the games. When I heard Frontlines Fuel the War was finally out, I went down to the local game shop, picked up a copy for the PC. After installing the game and playing it for a few hours, I wasn't overly impressed with it. It's not that the game looked bad or anything, it simply didn't do anything different from the other first-person shooters that are out there today. Granted, you do have access to drones you can mess with, but this gets old pretty fast. Along with the game not setting itself apart from the other games that are out there, it also comes with several problems. The first problem I heard of, this is after I got the game installed, is that the game's having problems with secure ROM, copy protection, and was giving some people a hard time during the install of the game on Vista. The first thing that stood out for me in terms of problems with the game was the fact that the game lacked any sort of cheat protection at all. I haven't seen a game in a long time that doesn't come with Punkbuster or Valve's anti-cheat system. The fact this game did come without any kind of cheat protection at all just goes to show you how fast the game was rushed out the door before it was actually done. They should have spent more time on it. The game is not a bad-looking game. In fact, some maps, like the Solar Farm, look, they got a map in there called Solar Farm that looks really well done. Despite the fact that the maps look good, though, on my system I was seeing a bit of lag in the game from time to time. Considering I didn't have the graphics cranked all the way up, this was a bit annoying to me as well. Overall, the game isn't horrible, but it's nothing to write home about. If they had have taken some more time to polish the game up and add things like the VoIP that they said they would have, it may have turned out to be a different game. I think the biggest problem is the fact that it has come out a few years too late. If the game had come out around the time of Battlefield 2, then I would be singing a different tune right about now. Probably be a much better game. Actually, it'd be more comparable to Battlefield 2 than anything else. Everything since Battlefield 2 has sort of moved on in one way or another, where this game here, you know, it just looks like it's a few years old, despite the fact that it should come out not that long ago. There'd be a full review of this game on my website in the next week or so, so if you want to see all the screenshots and get the full lowdown on the actual game, it'll be up there at some point in time to review on my site. The next thing I've been keeping an eye on is the game duo from EA, Electronic Arts, sometime this summer called Battlefield Heroes. This is going to be a game you can download for free, but you'll have to put up with in-game advertising, since that's how EA plans on paying for the development of the game. a bit skeptical about this idea of an ad-based game. From what I understand, the ads are only going to show up during the load time. So every time you load up a map, you go from, you know, map to map or whatever. You're going to see these little ads sitting there as you watch your little progress bar move across the screen. I'm sure this will impress a lot of people. But, I mean, if it's a free game and it's good, some people will probably put up with that. Along with the in-game ads, they're also going to make the game so that you can buy some things that will make your character look different. So they're trying to get into the MMO aspect of this now. They want you to invest a lot of time in your character, or money in this case. EA is probably hoping that it will bring lots of cash along with the advertising. So between the two, between the fact you can do what they call micro-payments in-game, which basically means suck money from you, and the fact that they can also do the advertising, between the two of those, they'll probably make more money off a single game when they do this than they have previously. If the game's good, that is. If the game sucks, it ain't going to matter. They're not going to make anything. The reason I say tune is because this game, the game of EA, is going to be a cartoon-based multiplayer shooter. You'll be able to have online matches of up to 16 players at once and run around in this cartoon world that's based on World War II theme. There will be vehicles to fly and drive, but as of yet, I haven't heard of how many vehicles are going to be in the actual maps. The only problem I see with the game so far is a 16-player limit per match. I think this is way too small, and if you only have 16 players a map, it won't be very big. And if you have vehicles as well in the mix, and you got these small little maps, that's only going to equal problems. It's not going to be too fun. And actually, that's the one thing I miss now about games like Desert Combat and such. None of these games that have come out recently have the actual great big maps you used to be able to play with in them games. So that's a bit of a drag. Seems like all these games that are coming out, Call of Duty was a good example of that. Call of Duty 4, you're getting some of these maps that are just so, they're small. It's confined. I hate that. I want to be in a nice big map, or if I got a tank, or if I got 10 tanks, we can all drive around and get to the destinations. Seems like a lot of games are getting smaller. Better looking graphics, but they're not as big. Only time will tell if this new ad-based game of EA's will work out or not. It's something I'll be keeping an eye on, and I'll even download it and check it out when the thing's released. It'll be interesting to see. They're not the first guys to start doing this advertising thing. Apparently over in other countries and stuff, in Europe and whatever, these ad-based games are probably a bigger thing there than they are over here in Canada and the U.S. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. Okay, the last thing on the list is it's a utility called Process Explorer. For those that don't know, this is a program like the Windows Task Manager, except this thing tells you way more information. The type of person who will be willing to use a program like this is the person who wants to know everything about what their machine is doing in terms of running processes. When you load Process Explorer, it shows you everything that's running on the machine. And if you highlight one of the processes on the machine, it will show you what files and registry keys that particular process is using. Now this here, what I just mentioned here, that's invaluable just in of itself. If you, say for example, if you get spyware on your machine or just something iffy that you're not really sure what it is, you can turn on and enable this second view that shows up under the first view. Again, if you go to my website, I did the full review on this, and you'll see the screenshots, what I'm talking about. But in the lower view, you can, when you click on a process, it'll show you every registry key that a program's using, or actually that the program that you have selected is using, and also any files that it wants to open to write to or read to. It shows you all that as well. So it's incredibly valuable just for that. Just for that one thing alone, the program is unreal. It's worth its weight in gold. Along with that, though, if you double-click on a process, you get a properties window to show up, and it tells you where the file is located on the hard drive. This here is a big thing for me, too. For years now, I would turn around if I wanted to see what a process was doing. I'd do the same thing everybody else would do. You know, I'd hit Control-Alt-Delete, get the process name, and then go into the Start button in Windows XP and do the whole search thing and try and find the file. Well, with this thing here, you just double-click on it, you get like a properties window that comes up, and in that properties window, it tells you exactly where the file is, along with a whole bunch of other stuff. Like, it tells you not just where the file is, but how much RAM it's using, if it's doing any communication via the internet. It just goes on and on and on. There's a whole bunch of tabs you can hit to see what this thing's doing, what the actual process is doing. If you right-click on the process, you can do a search online for the process name. The search will use Google, and then you can see the Google listings for the process name. And basically what that's good for is if you don't know what a process is, you just go, and you can do this manually, you can take your browser and go into Google and go into your task manager and look at the actual process name, type it into Google, and the Google will come back and give you an idea of what it thinks that file is for. It's good not to panic though, because a lot of times Google comes back with companies that run spyware software, virus checkers and all that, and some of the process names that should be in a Windows install come back and they say, well, this might contain a virus or this and that. And so that's something you got to keep in mind. There's no point in panicking about it. The interesting thing about the program, Process Explorer, is that it can also turn around and verify the signature. Now, a lot of these files, it seems like only Microsoft or really big corporations that have a lot of money go through the hassle of getting their files digitally signed. And the good thing about this is that this program, Process Explorer, can turn around and tell you what files are signed. So you, at least you have an idea, somewhat of an idea, if the files that you're looking at, like say all the Microsoft files, like SVCH host, all them things that load up, if they're legitimate or not. Because a lot of viruses and Trojans will turn around and masquerade themselves as a legitimate Microsoft process. So this whole thing where this program can check the signatures of files and look to see if they're digitally signed and to actually see if the signature is valid or not is just, it's unbelievable. Like, the fact this thing already does what I previously mentioned and it does this too is just, program is great. Program is also totally free. It doesn't cost any money at all. Basically freeware. It's done by Mark Rusinovich. That guy had his own website called SysInternals, which ultimately got bought by Microsoft, so now he's working for them, for Microsoft. And all these utilities you can get off Microsoft's site, still totally free of charge. And the guy who made this program here just doesn't make one utility. He's probably got 50 or 60 or maybe even more than that on the Microsoft site that you can check out. Everything from packet sniffers to all kinds of stuff. So really good guy, really good programs he makes, top notch. I've never seen nothing like this thing before. So if you want, you can go onto my website. I already did the full review of this Process Explorer program. There's screenshots on there and so on and so forth. Getting back to the verified digital signatures on the files, though, some of them files, actually not so much the files, but if a hacker wanted to, he could turn on and hack Process Explorer. He could insert certain things in the way Process Explorer works to show you a file that's not supposed to be verified as showing up as verified. Now keep in mind, this would have to be a direct attack on Process Explorer, which I asked Mark about this, and currently he doesn't know of any attacks like that. So for the time being, at least, it's an excellent way to see if you're looking at legitimate Microsoft files. The one thing to keep in mind about this program, though, is that not all files are digitally signed. There's a whole bunch of files, like everything, my Nostromo N50 SpeedPad that I use. None of its software is signed, so it shows up as unsigned. Some of the ATI software shows up signed, but other parts of it show up not signed. Winamp's another good example. It doesn't show up as signed as well. So you got to keep in mind, just because something isn't signed doesn't mean that it's a virus or a Trojan or something like that. It just means that they might not have went through with the process. What I like about it is the fact that it shows you if all the Microsoft files have been signed. Because since a lot of viruses will try to get on your machine, or Trojans try to get on your machine, try to actually use the same name as some of the actual legitimate systems, system services and stuff like that, this is a huge thing. It's good to have this. Just that feature alone is excellent. So again, if you want to look at this program, go over to the website. I'll have the link for the program in the show notes, plus you can read the full review and the review links back to the program as well. Well, I think that's about it for now. I think this has probably dragged on long enough, tortured everybody long enough. I'd like to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to this netcast, and hope to have another one ready to go fairly soon. Keep in mind, these are going to get better as time goes on. I'm still experimenting with, you know, compressors and mixers and how far the microphone is away and all this other crap. So it's probably going to take a while to iron this out. Plus, these things take a lot of time. There's a lot of editing involved, so on and so forth. All the articles in the netcast have links. Like I said before, they'll show up on the show notes. If you go into the multimedia section of my website, you'll see this netcast in there along with, I want to put in there also, sort of a time index. So if you actually want to fast forward with an MP3 player, you can go to certain sections of the file. So anyway, with the time index, I'll put in all the links to all the articles I've talked about here, and you should be good to go. Feel free to share this netcast with any of your friends or family or loved ones, whatever you have going on there. If you want to upload it to P2P sites, BitTorrent, feel free to do so. The further you spread the actual file around, the better it'll be for me. So get to work. Spread the file around. This audio netcast is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 2.5 license for Canada. What a mouthful that is. More information on this license can be found on the bottom of my webpage, or actually any webpage on my site shows you the Creative Commons license. You can click on it, you can go there, you can see the details of the license that I'm using for these, and that should answer anybody's questions if they have any. If you have any comments about the license, or actually about this netcast in general, or anything that I do, you can use the forums. Please do use the forums. Don't use the feedback button on the site. That's intended for people manufacturing things and stuff like that to get a hold of me directly a lot quicker than if they have to go through and try and find email addresses and all that. Anybody else, any users that listen to these podcasts or watch the video cast or whatever, all you guys use the forum. That's what it's there for. Sign up. And away you go. Don't forget to visit my website at www.wolfmansbites.com. That's www.wolfmansbites.com. So that's about it. This is Wolfman 611, signing out.